Welcome back to the Dog Gone Wrong podcast, where myself and others share their mistakes and help you lift the guilt burden. I'm your host, Sarah Roper, the multi-dog maven.
Hello everyone. Today I have Lily Abbott, who happens to be my bestie, with me. We are sat here in our PJs in a twin room in a hotel, and we've just been to a dog conference. So we're going to do like a bit of a recap and kind of decompress and chat about things that we've heard today, what speakers have spoke about. Lil will be on the podcast, I reckon, quite regularly. I've had to bully her into doing this, and I can't believe we've got this far into podcast episodes without having her, because she's been, from the start, she said to me, we can only do this in our PJs, so here we are. And they will be slightly different to our normal episodes, because we sit there in our PJs regularly and then just put the world to rights when it comes to dogs. Lily is a fellow KCII trainer in Companion Dog and Good Citizen Dog Scheme, and also Assistance Dogs. She's a fellow ABTC ATI with the TCBTS, like me. She bullied me into doing that assessment. she's got ridiculous amount of qualifications. So, yeah. But we are quite often just putting the world's rights to do with dogs. So, today I wanted to go through. We've just been to DogX, and we've been all the way down, right down south. We're currently staying in Southampton. We've been to Winchester for DogX, which is run by PACT. And it's essentially, it's like TEDx talks or TED talks, which I am a massive fan of.
Yeah.
I love TED talks on all sorts of different subjects. And if you've never listened to TED talks, even if it's not to do with dogs, go and have a Google or a YouTube. They're like 20 minutes long, or 17 minutes, are they?
Yeah.
On like every single subject you could think of. And a lot of them are really inspirational. So if you've never heard of them, then go and check them out. So this conference was very much in that style. So shorter talks. I have to admit, because of my neurospicy brain, I used to be a seminar junkie, but I did also very much struggle with the length of the talks and seminars and things like that, because my brain couldn't focus for that long, and then I'd get really fidgety and end up playing dots with the person next to me and just, yeah, and escaping for a fag, and that, now it's escaping for a vape, but, you know, times change. But at least having the shorter talks was a lot easier. It was really engaging. It was a really, really well-run event, to the point where we even had a cello player singing random songs about politics and all sorts at the end, and then there was Prosecco, so it was all good. But really nicely ran event. But we're going to go through each speaker, what they spoke about, what our thoughts were. I'm going to just quickly refer to my phone as a reminder. It's been a long day. And Lil is going to tell you about her dogs and do a bit of an intro for her while I'm faffing with my phone. Just a couple of minutes.
Okay. So I'll start off with the three undercover Labradors, who are actually German Shepherd cross German Pointers. They are about 12 years old now.
Yeah,
I'll have to actually check. That's really bad.
Sorry to interrupt, but years ago when we met, I was always the one who kind of wound her up and said they're Labradors, because they look like Labradors.
They do.
And she was always like, they're not Labradors. They're German Shepherds cross German Pointers. And I was like, yeah, but they're Labradors. And she was so against it, to the point where loads of people would say to her, like even Labrador breeders would be like, yeah, they're Labradors. I know. Which they're not. She knows this. She bred them by accident. You know, it wasn't planned. And I wound her up over the years calling them Labradors. And now she calls them Labradors herself.
Yeah, Richard still calls them the undercover Labradors. But yeah, they do look like Labradors. For the dog training people on this, you can all cringe that I have three siblings. I've had siblings before. I probably will again in the future. It's never planned. It's just the way things happen. One came back. There's a whole story too. It wasn't just a irresponsible breeding, there was a whole thing, it was a rescue case, and just, yeah, but they're all fab, and they're all wonderful, and they've done Crufts, so they've all got their gold good sits and everything else. Then we have my absolute idiot of a shepherd, who is a black long-coated shepherd called Ezekiel, who is my previous assistance dog, who is now retired, And yeah, we might have to do a podcast about him at some point. Oh, because that's a whole story.
Yeah, you've got loads of fuck-ups around him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then I have my absolute twat bag of a sausage currently lying between my legs. That's going to sound really wrong, but which was actually bred by Sarah. And
yeah, the ship breeder.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely terrible breeder. I mean, I've tried to get a refund and she just said no.
No.
Yeah, these puppy farmers are terrible, aren't they? You know, I mean, he was just like raised in a shed, didn't know his parents were.
To be clear, Lil pretty much moved in for the 8 weeks before she took him home.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was even there for his conception.
You were.
Was that involved? But no, he's my current assistance dog and he is my absolute heart and soul. I love him to bits. But my first dachshund, my first very small dog, and yeah, I'm really liking hounds.
Yes.
Like I say, it's a terrier turned down a notch.
Yeah.
And I'm a terrier lady.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's all good. But yes, the five dogs currently, hopefully a sixth to be added soon, but we shall see.
Cool. Right, so the first speaker this morning, I mean, what I really liked this morning was she called Nat?
Yes.
She came on and she just made everyone feel at ease. And it really, you know, she was down to earth, having a laugh.
Yeah.
And I liked that. You know, she's like, oh, and I've got a boring bit. I mean, really serious bits. These are your fire exits.
And then couldn't find them.
But no, she was lovely. And it was really nice. Because I mean, I personally haven't been to a in-person event. I don't know, probably in about 4 years.
A long time.
The last in-person event I went to, it wasn't particularly about dog training. It was about marketing for pet businesses. And before then, I couldn't actually tell you. When I used to be a real junkie, as I've said before, I used to be like pretty much every other weekend on things. Before we met.
Before we never met, I don't know.
I don't know. Because we had so many, we've still got so many mutual friends.
Yeah. And mutual places we've been at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. Randomly, how we met was I did a win my book kind of share and like thing on when I wrote the first book, which is another book, which was all about kind of bringing Ripple in as the sixth dog into the household. And Lily won it. And she messaged me a few times after, very complimentary messages, but and we got chatting. And then things went quiet for a bit. I think that was like November-ish time.
Yeah.
And then we both applied, not knowing, but we both applied to be on the Good Sits Gold team, or at least for the tryouts, for Crufts the following year. And the tryouts are like early January, or they were at that point. And I'd not long since received the news that my dad had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I'll be honest, I got up that morning for the tryouts and it was like I didn't want to go, but something in me was like, just do it, just go. And I got there and I remember there was like, I was driving a tiny little car because I was only taking a taxi, I wasn't going to take the van. And I know from both Lil and her husband that they were both like, what the hell is going to turn up in that? Because it was a tiny little like convertible, like old mini style size, like
two-seater, no boot.
I'd kind of like it earmarked that I knew that Lil was there because we'd all been added to this group, I think. I knew that Lil was there, and she went out for a vape as she does, and I followed her out at one point, and I kind of come round a bit by then. I was like, oh, I'm here, I'm just gonna give it my best go. And I went up to her and I says, oh, yeah, you're right. And she looked at me, gone out, like, who the fuck are you? And then...
I was really rich.
You were. And then I pointed down and I went, this is Ripple. And she went, oh, my God, you know.
And just completely went nuts over Ripple and was just like, I don't know who you are and I don't care who you are. Give me the dog.
Because she'd read the whole book about Ripple. And even though we'd both got on the team and that, it wasn't really until a good few months after I'd seen that she'd posted that she was driving a pony, and obviously I carriage drive as well. So I messaged her and I said, you drive? And she was like, oh, yeah, I drive my friends, usually at Christmas, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you need to come on a drive. And then we went on this drive and we got absolutely soaking wet. But we were out for a good couple of hours and that was it then. You know, like, we are literally joined at the hip, even though we live at the opposite ends of the country. But, yeah, we get on like a house on fire. Anyway, back to packed, unless you've got anything else to add to that story.
No, just, I'm really sorry. I was really rude to you.
It's not in the best of moods.
No.
Because your husband was outshining you, basically.
He did. Exactly, yeah. I was very nearly not on the team. And then they were, oh, we need an extra dog. And so I kind of came on. But yeah.
Yeah, but you had kind of bullied your husband into being there. He didn't want to be there.
Yeah, well, that is a bit of a thing, though, isn't it? So he'd got rather inebriated one night, and I was like, oh, do you want to try out for Crufts? And he was like, oh, no, whatever. I was like, oh, good, because I've signed you up. Which we'll come on to about ABTC, because I did that to you.
Yeah, you did. But I did say you'd bullied me into that anyway. Yeah. But there is a theme. Anyway, so after Nat had been on at PAC, Linda Michaels came on, and I've never seen her in person before. American lady. I've been in her Do No Harm Facebook group for many years, and I was aware of her book, Do No Harm Dog Training. But I really actually enjoyed her talk. And she started off with a bit of an introduction to her history and things like that. But then what I really liked was she's quite humble. Because she said that she got this opportunity. I don't think you were in at that point. I think you might have took Ig out for a wee. She'd been, earlier on in her career, she'd been offered this opportunity to work with wolf dogs, having never worked with wolf dogs before. But, of course, she was like, yes, I'm going to take this opportunity. And apparently she, like, knowing that she knew nothing, and she'd gone in there with high-value treats in a treat bag on a hip. And then she walked into this enclosure, and she basically, in her words, she got nailed. and it was, very humbling. And she obviously did work with them in the end and things like that. But she is, if you've never heard of her, she is the mother of the hierarchy of dog needs, which is like a pyramid, if you imagine it. And at the bottom is like biological needs. And then above that, you've got emotional needs. Then social needs, and then force-free dog training needs, and then cognitive needs on the top. And I really liked her talk. It was really engaging. And I don't think, actually, there was anything that she said that I could disagree with or not get on board with. I mean, what was your thoughts on her?
She was fab. And she was really humble. It was really clear that she knows so much, but she was just so down to earth and just one of us. And it's the first time she's ever spoken in the UK.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And she was just fantastic. And it was just, and it kind of mirrors Maslin's hierarchy, which I use a lot for people. And it's really nice to see.
She did.
Both, yeah. But it's so nice to see the dog one alongside of it and to know where it came from.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so important. And I try to follow that. Because even though I wasn't on a group and I haven't read a book and know about her work and I've known about her work for years, and she was just absolutely, on a really engaging as well.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't kind of just talking at you.
Mm.
It was just, yeah, she was fab.
She was. And what I think, going on quite a deeper level for me, what she said, we all know, or at least we as dog trainers know, that the average dog is equivalent to a 2 or 3 year old child cognitively or mentally. And she also addressed attachment, and some of my background is, I've done courses in therapy and things like that, and emotional education and things to do with humans more than anything else. And I've been through a lot of therapy myself. And when she was talking about attachment, I've done a lot of study in attachment, and I know you have too. I mean, you did a lot. I mean, is your degree in psychology? Yeah. So
yeah.
Lil's degree to do with her work is in psychology. So she is definitely the lady to talk to. But what really hit home to me was the fact that she was essentially saying, not just, we know this about dogs being like a toddler, but always a toddler throughout their lives, and about frustration and things like that. We know that toddlers like to kick off and have a paddy and all of this because they can't deal with frustration, and we teach dogs to deal with frustration because we have longer years with them being a toddler than a toddler is. But the attachment side really hit home to me, and I actually started thinking more about how I've been very aware of the attachment side, and I was, shall we say, rejected by my parents at three.
Hmm.
And, you know, went to live with my grandparents at that age. And that's obviously had effects in part of the reason why I've been in therapy and things like that. But then thinking about it in dog terms, I've not really put it into those, like the attachment side.
Yeah.
I'd not really put it into those terms. And, you know, in some ways I was thinking, well, there's no wonder I am so protective over my dogs.
Yes.
And that attachment to me and my attachment to them, because it's all about safety and all about feeling that safety and secure attachment.
Yeah.
Because I'm fully aware I'm probably overprotective of my dogs, but it's also a reason why I decided to never have children, because I realised that I was never,
same for me.
I never could, you know, this world is not a nice place. And this might be hard for some of the listeners to hear, but this is my view because of my experiences, that I couldn't knowingly bring a child into this world in the state that it's currently in, because I know I couldn't protect them. When with dogs, I am so hyper-vigilant and probably too much in some ways. I mean, what are your thoughts on that kind of part of the...
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm going to come back to that, because I've got a thought in my head. If I don't say it now,
yep,
I'm going to lose it. And I forgot to speak to you about it because it came to me at the time. So my area that I love to work on is teenagers, as you know.
Oh, yeah.
And if you think about it, having worked with children in the past, two-year-olds, at 2 years old, that's where a human child will start to say no. They don't understand what no means, but they're testing out what no means. By three, they've learned that and they start to understand that resilience and they have a choice in what they're doing.
Mm.
So if you then relate that to a dog, especially with early neutering, at the point that they are a teenager, which is 2 years old, as a human child, you're locking that dog into that no stage.
Yep.
They don't understand what no means. They're just going, no, I'm not doing it. So for me, it was really important, actually, because I was like, hang on, if we early neuter, we're locking that dog into the naughty two-year-olds, and we all know about, you know, terrible twos.
Before you carry on, can you just clarify for the listeners what early neutering is? Like, between the age bracket.
So for me, early neutering is anything really before 18 months, 2 years, if I'm honest with you. I prefer 2 years, because you're locking them into that teenage stage.
Oh, I'm totally with you. I'm just trying to clarify for the listeners. So... what would be the differences between a small dog and a big dog with the age brackets?
So with a small dog, you might get away with sort of a year old because they mature quicker. With a big dog, so I don't know, a retriever, a German shepherd, you definitely want to wait till about 18 months, 2 years old if possible. But yeah, so especially if you neuter, so for example, my big boy, Lazarus, he was neutered at 5 months old. Mm-hmm. Now he's 12, 13 this year. I didn't have that knowledge back then. I'd never do that now. But I've locked him into, basically being a teenager for the rest of his life. And he's not fully matured. So you can see from his face and his body, he's not built out. But it's really, really just made me think, because I was like, hang on a second. So we're neutering these dogs early and we're keeping them in the teenage stage, but we're also locking them into the equivalent of a two-year-old, which is the terrible twos, which is why... this, you know, if you don't work through these issues with teenagers, you get dogs with behavioural problems. Whereas if we leave it a little bit later, you might still have behavioural problems, but you tend to have a dog with a little bit more resilience.
Yeah.
Because they now know, actually, I don't want to do that, but yes, I'll do that. And actually, I'll do that different behaviour. So instead of jumping up, yes, I'll happily sit.
Yeah.
But then, and then he went on to the attachment side, and I'm the same as you, as I'm, you know, I'm ridiculously overprotective of my dogs. And I've had to really learn not to be, especially with Ignatius, to give him that chance. But I think absolutely the psychology of it, you know, you're going to be overprotective. And I'm the same as you, I never wanted kids because I was like, hang on a second, I couldn't protect myself in my own life.
Agreed.
And if I can't protect myself, I'm not going to be able to protect someone else. Yeah. And this is a person. And that sounds terrible because obviously I want to protect my dogs, but I think it's easier with dogs as well because we have bred them to be biddable, you know, which also we'll come on to later with one of the other sessions. But we have so much control over their lives.
Mm.
When you don't with a child, and I think my biggest fear would be that kind of 13 to 18 age of not being able to protect them, them having their own mind, wanting to go out into the world. I just couldn't face that. I'd never be able to forgive myself if something happened.
Yeah, because, there's too much out there. There's too much risk.
Yeah.
I'm totally with you on that one.
But then she also, and this really broke my heart, and I honestly, I don't know how I didn't end up in tears, because she was saying, dogs are as attached to us as toddlers, and you get that completely. And then she's like, so think about the dogs that are then given up to rescue. And there are very good reasons I'm not saying that's wrong. I've had to do it in the past. But it nearly broke me, because I was like,
yeah,
they are that attached to us. And then all of a sudden, they're like, where have we gone? You know,
and the same parts of the brain, they did an fMRI on quite a few, the same parts of the brain light up. With you know, the happy hormones, without going into, you know, all the terminology, that a baby does when it sees its parents, you know, who it's most attached to, and vice versa. A dog's brain lights up in the same way as a baby does when it sees its owner. That is what says, you know, and this, a lot of it today was very much about what the scientific studies are. This is not just us talking about, oh, well, you know, so-and-so said this.
Yeah.
It's the science behind it. And we'll come on to some things that I've been a bit like, today.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, if that's what the science is saying, we need to start to kind of question even our own thoughts and our own beliefs. And that's what CPD is all about. But yeah, I mean, she was basically the keynote speaker. She was obviously placed first on, so you were the most engaged. Yeah. She had the longest talk, and I genuinely really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I really did.
Yeah.
I'd happily pay to go and see her again, or if she did online courses and stuff like that. Totally. Okay, so next we had, he was called Ryan, I know that much.
Yes, because he's doing his PhD. I remember
And it was based around multi-dogs, which is obviously my bag. And I did ask him a question later. Bear with me. Let me just find it on my phone. Ryan Dillon, BSc, ONS, MSc, PACT, KSA, ABTC, ATI. And the title of his talk was, Are Dogs Averse to Inequality Training? Should we be cautious of multi-dog training sessions? So essentially, what he was saying was that if you have multi-dogs and you're working them together, or at least you have multi-dogs, and one dog gets a treat, or one dog gets a better treat than another, the science, the studies are currently showing that, you know, that the dog perceives this and actually gets frustrated and angry and all of that, which I'm sure everyone listening, if you have multi-dogs, you will agree with this. I've seen it. Oh, he showed us a video of one of the studies that was done with monkeys. You know, it was comical in some ways, because the monkey that was getting, one of the monkeys was getting, basically the deal was, you give me a, you give the scientist a pebble and you get a treat in reward. And that was the study. But there were two monkeys next to each other, but with a barrier between them, but they could see each other like mesh. And one of them would give the pebble and they'd get something like a piece of cucumber, and the other one that was next to it would get a grape, and the grape was the more rewarding or higher value reward, and the one who kept getting, and he could obviously see when the other one was giving a pebble and getting a grape, and the one who was getting the cucumber actually picked up a pebble and threw it at the scientist in anger, and then was like bouncing off the barrier between him and the scientist, having a paddy, you know, getting angry, getting frustrated. So I don't disagree with this. And he, you know, he was showing that the science was currently showing this. What I found was, my personal thoughts was, it was a very interesting finding, but I felt it was slightly lacking of understanding of working with and training multiple dogs, in my own opinion, because that's obviously my specialism. For my own thoughts, it's more about, of course, I'm not saying the dogs don't feel this, that's what the science is showing. However, building up resilience within dogs of, you've got to be patient and it will come, is part of the process. So, for example, what I train with my guys is, you guys can go and settle, I'm going to get one out of work, but you're still going to get rewarded when you're settling. And then we're going to swap. So the rewards will come anyway when you get up. So it's always fair, but you have to have that patience in the meantime. And you will get rewarded for settling. Like, I will take brief breaks while I'm working one dog to then come back and reward you, then I'll be working the dog. And it is a question I asked at the end.
Yeah.
And he kind of agreed with me, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Would
yeah.
you say? But I mean, what were your thoughts on his talk?
Well, it was the bit that he was saying about in classes where there's multiple dogs. And I get it, because it's really hard when you're taking a class that you might see a dog offering a behaviour and the handler hasn't picked up on it.
Yes.
And I get that, but he was also saying, yeah, but if the dog's doing a behaviour and getting rewarded by its handler, but there's a dog across the way that's also doing the behaviour, but perhaps the handler isn't as quick with the rewards, then that dog's going to stop working because it's going to go, well, hang on, that one's getting more treats. Mm. And we do see that to an extent, but that's, I hate to say it, that's part of life. And the dog needs to work through that.
I agree. And that was what was going through my head at the time. One of the things that I do teach is life fucking sucks sometimes. Yeah. And dogs need to learn to deal with this.
Well, they do.
Because you're going to miss out, but other times you're going to get it. So it's just the way it is.
Well, my head went to, okay, so you're sitting at the pub and you're having a nice meal and the dog's sitting with you and you're eating your meal and the dog's going, well, I'm sitting here really patiently and I'm not getting any burger. Well, yes. No, you're not going to. You're not being fed from the table. No. But that's still inequality of reward.
Yes, it is.
As he called it. And I was like, well, yeah, he's going to get a treat or a chew or something on the floor, but no, I'm not going to sit there feeding my dog half my meal.
No.
Or feeding the dog treats while I'm eating. They've got to learn that restraint.
Yeah. But, like, one of the questions that came at the end to him was about kids and dogs and the jealousy between them.
Yeah.
And I think that applies to that. And he basically said there is no studies on it. And he's obviously quite a scientific guy. I enjoyed it and I thanked him for the talk. What he did say, which I don't find surprising, however, I don't think my guys apply to this because of the way I've been with them, is what he was saying was, if you had two dogs, like there's been a study done, if you have two dogs next to each other, they're offering the same behaviour when there's a bowl of food in front of them to be rewarded for this behaviour, the one that keeps getting rewarded for, say, giving a paw, will carry on doing it. Obviously, it's been a rewarded behaviour. The one that keeps offering the behaviour and then doesn't get a reward will stop doing the behaviour very quick when in the presence of another dog that's doing it and getting rewarded. Quicker, you will see an extinction of that behaviour quicker than if they were just on their own, because they're seeing that someone else is getting rewarded and they're not, so they're like, yeah, sod this, I ain't doing it anymore. That doesn't surprise me. However, I think the way I train most clients and my own dogs is I've built that resilience of keep trying.
Yeah. However, I'm going to turn that on its head, because very often I will go into a multi-dog household, there'll be one dog that's constantly jumping up when you go through the door, and the other dog will sit politely. So when I go in, the dog that's sitting politely will constantly get rewarded, and the dog that's jumping up won't get anything. And
all of a sudden,
that's it. And then the dog will go, well, I'm not getting anywhere jumping up. They're sitting down and getting rewarded. I'm going to sit and get rewarded.
Exactly. And that is a massive part of the way I train.
And they?
Like, I was doing a bit of the settle training, as in while I'm working one, like just last week, because I was introducing Ada to it.
Yeah.
But she hasn't really done any of that. The other guys know it. But obviously now I've also got Moss, who's a lot older, who wants to come out and do things, but he's retired. And he now needs to learn, do you know what, you just settle, that's it.
Yeah.
It sounds mean, but you're not going to come out and do anything. You're going to get rewarded for being there. But there isn't going to really be a release queue for this until we're all done. There's not going to be a release to come out and work. So rewarding the dog that is doing the right behaviour when the one next to it is shuffling and maybe trying to break, the one that's sitting and doing the right behaviour gets all the rewards. I don't care what the one that I've got out to do is doing at that point, because I'm focusing on them settling. But the one that's shuffling about doesn't get anything until they make the right choice and they go, wait a minute, they're doing the down, they're getting fed. Oh, I'll try the down. Now he'll get fed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I can see where it could cause conflict, perhaps with children, especially if the child has come after the dog's been in the household.
Yes.
So I think that'd be quite. I mean, I generally pass those cases to a colleague of ours.
Slight hiatus in recording. We were talking about competition between other dogs and rewards. And to be fair, I've always been the case of, do you know what, life sucks and you've got to miss out sometimes.
So I was saying back, like in my day, like, you know, showing my age here, you used to get rewarded with Smarties.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, whoever'd got the most gold stars actually got a tube of Smarties as well, back in the day when they were around, just to like show my absolute disgrace at the hexagonal Smarties.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they're now hexagonal with a cardboard top that folds over as well. Oh, for God's sake. It's wrong. I know. And they took the orange ones out as well, just to make it worse. Okay. But yeah, and you used to sit there and you'd like get a smarter, like, you know, you've done really well. You got like, you know, 5 on your maths test and that. But that actually used to make you work harder as well, because you'd like, yeah, but hang on, I want the smarties.
Mm.
Well, you better work harder then. Okay, I'll work harder.
Yeah.
And you need that bit of competition. You don't want it to become like food aggression level, obviously, but you do need a little bit of kind of, well, I'm going to work harder. Well, it's the same as putting it on a reward schedule, mm-hmm. like a random, so instead of going, I'm going to reward you for every time you sit, I'm going to reward you for every 3, every 2, every 5. You're never going to know when the next reward's coming.
Yes, it's random.
That is, and that makes that behaviour stronger.
Yep.
So yeah, I see where he's coming from. And I think you do have to be careful to an extent. I can see what he was saying about you might need to screen personalities.
Yes.
But yeah, I think you can train through that as well, though.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. The thing is, when I walk into multi-dog households, if there's 2 dogs, quite often that's a what I would class as a pet dog owner. They happen to get a second one.
Yeah.
When you've got more than 2, they're a pet enthusiast.
Yes.
And they're a bit more savvy.
Yeah.
And they know a bit more about dog body language, and they know they've got to put the work in, because the jump from 2 to 3 is massive, which I've said enough times, and I know you totally agree with.
When you get to the level of our dogs, then you're usually thinking they're probably a trainer.
Yeah, exactly. Or they're doing dog sports, so they're doing something
that's
with their
dogs. Yes.
So they're a lot more driven to put the work in. I mean, when I say that I do this settle work, they're not perfect. I know that I couldn't go to a seminar and demo with one of the dogs having the other 3 on, you know, I'm not at that stage because I haven't put the work in. I know I could if I had the want and the time.
Yeah.
But I also think it's valuable that they learn this patience that, do you know what, sometimes the others or one other is going to do stuff. And I'm going to miss out. I'm going to get rewarded for being where I am, but I'm not going to be getting all the fun stuff.
But don't you think, to an extent, not to go off on too much of a tangent here and not to annoy anyone.
This is this podcast.
But there are some real benefits to old-fashioned dog training. And I mean very specific bits of, don't touch the dog when it's eating.
Yep.
Don't wake the dog up when it's asleep.
Yep.
You know, don't start ragging in its face and winding it up. And don't keep sort of like offering something to the other dog and wind the other dog up. Like, we just need to go back to a bit of common sense.
That's what it comes down to for me.
Yeah.
It's all about common sense, which we seem to, as a generation maybe, or at least as the country.
So definitely society.
Society, that's the word I'm looking for. As a society, we've kind of lost that. And children and young people aren't learning that when it comes to dogs. You know, it was in, you know, when I was growing up, if you approached the dog when they're eating the ground, it was your fault.
Absolutely.
It was not the dog's fault. No. It was, of course, you don't approach the dog when you're eating. Of course they're going to growl. Back off.
Yeah.
When now, if a child approaches a dog and they growl, it's the dog's fault. And the dog is evil for doing it.
Well, I say this all the time. Come at me when I'm eating, see how you get.
Exactly.
Because I will stab you with my fork.
The fact.
Well, you know, perfect example. So I've just been up here.
Mm.
And he's just chosen to go off to his box, which you probably just heard him jumping down or whatever. And he's gone to have a sleep.
Mm.
I'm not going to go and drag him out of his box and go, no, you will be on this podcast, and you will sit here. He's tired. He's gone to his bed.
I think he's allowed.
That's it. Absolutely. That's
his decision.
Yeah,
exactly. He's allowed to have that. Okay. So before, because we could go,
we could rant on
for this. So the next one
Part 6.
What?
Part 6 coming up.
Part 6 coming up. was Tamsin Durston, which I have invited on the podcast, so hopefully we get to welcome her very soon. I met Tamsin well over a decade ago. We used to go on the same courses. She's such a lovely lady. And she even said when she came on she was nervous.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't her kind of thing.
Yeah.
What I really liked about her talk was it was about training dogs to be optimistic.
Yeah.
To expect or look for happiness, and for the handlers to look after themselves on all levels to be happier. And it was all about positivity. And I think in the current industry, you know, she was speaking to a room of dog professionals, trainers, behaviourists, primarily, really, I'd say, to give up their Sunday and spend over £100 to get there, really. You know, they are dedicated to dogs. But we also know that as an industry, we very much become quite disheartened at times.
Oh, yeah.
And it can be quite depressing. because we're trying our best and you know, and the dogs are not getting what they need. And especially if you're working in rescue, it's just hard.
It is.
And I really liked her energy. And, you know, she gave some examples of fun things she was doing in classes about, like, going to dog warts and having the sorting hat. And the dogs were, you know, she'd had a sort, like, a hat, basically a witch's hat that was hung on a piece of string. So the owners would have to get the dogs to do a sit and a wait so they could take a picture while they were under the sorting hat. But it got the owners more engaged to practice a sit and a stay or a wait, depending on how you train it. For a picture than if you'd just gone, right, everyone get up, right, you're going to practice sits and stays, which, let's face it, would most go, all right then, boring. I mean, what did you think of Tantu?
I think she's fab. I loved her positivity. I really did. And I think it is so important because I think we do forget to look after ourselves. And a lot of dog trainers specifically and behaviourists will suffer from burnout. Because it's just, we just keep going and going and going. And it can be so disheartening, can't it? Mm. Especially when, sometimes when you're working with clients and you have to realise that, you know, life does get in the way. And not everybody can practice however many times a day and you know, have this perfect, we all love to live in this perfect bubble and we don't.
No.
So yeah, I think it is really nice to sometimes, wait. And what I love that she said at the end in the Q&A was, think about, if you were to ask that dog, how do you feel, what would they say to you?
And they'd say, thank you. Yeah, the last dog you worked with.
That's it, yeah. Each day, think about the last dog you worked with and what would they say to you. I really liked that.
Yeah, I liked that. I really did. It was quite an emotional day today.
It was, although I did think, actually, if the last dog I worked with was Ezekiel, he would probably tell me, well, yeah, Mum, I didn't get enough treats. And quite frankly, I'm just going to bark in your face because I don't feel like you've given me enough in life. Even though I've given him every ounce of my being, he'd be like, it's not enough, Mum. It's not enough. I am abused. Yeah. And yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I think I'd have to probably pick a different dog.
Yeah, no, I get that. The other thing that she said was to have, as an owner or, you know, a person, have a folder of fun, which is basically positive reinforcement for yourself. So whether this is tickets to gigs, days out, holidays, etc. And you know what? Life sometimes sucks and things get cancelled. You can't do things, but replace those things with something else. Make a conscious effort to replace those things with something else and look after yourself because you cannot take care of anything or anyone else until you look after yourself. And I think that was a really valuable thing to hear.
Yeah, and I think us in particular, we do that when we're together, don't we? If something's cancelled, we'll book something else in to make that time.
Yeah, we will. This year we've done loads, especially competing with the dogs and stuff, than we've done in previous years in a lot of ways. But, you know, I moved across the country.
Yes, I know, you abandoned me.
Yeah.
I am abandoned.
You are abused. But with, you know, more so you, I have to say, you've made the effort to come over to me. And we've had weekends and we've done things with dogs, with horses and just, we've self-cared.
We've also pushed ourselves well out of the comfort zone by going to hydrotherapy for someone who's petrified of swimming pools. And then their Daxi decides, oh, there's the deep end. Let me have a look and I'll just jump in. Yes. And there's me shouting to you, save my dog, I can't do it.
So I did.
Because I could see my poor sausage going, I've made a terrible mistake. And he was fine. Yep. He'd got his life jacket and everything on, but I was just like, I can't save you.
Yep. So this is the way that me and Lil usually are. For stuff like that, I'll go and save the dog. It's not the first time. And then she bullies me into getting more qualifications and assessments, basically.
Yeah, works well, doesn't it?
It does, it works well. It works well. We bully each other. Right, so the next one was the dog egg presentation. So it was more, I'll be honest, it was nice that they were there, but it wasn't, for me, it wasn't particularly educational, so we're going to move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah. Steph Rousseau, I think that's how you pronounce her name.
I think so.
She was from Dublin?
Yes.
And she is a student of Turid Rugas.
Yeah.
Turid Rugas, if you've never heard from her, she's kind of like who, basically the dog mother of body language, of calming signals, of all of that. You know, she's an absolute legend within the industry.
Yeah, she is.
And she's co-wrote a book on raising puppies with Turid Rugas. What her whole thing was... Her thing was dog-centric puppy raising. That was her kind of coined term. And less importance on kind of drilling sits, downs, stays, all of that kind of stuff. And more on educating the owner on what's normal, like mouthing, teething, exploring the world, picking things up, stealing things, all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, education on what's normal and what's not. And she particularly kind of put the importance on outdoor classes in normal environments, etc. Now, her talk, I would say, was probably, while I enjoyed it, the others were better.
Yeah.
And I think I think she's probably a little bit out of her comfort zone.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't necessarily disagree with what she was saying within the talk. There were some of the questions that came after that don't sit well with me. But that's not to say she's wrong. It's just the fact that we all do things differently. This is why years ago I stopped doing puppy classes.
Yeah.
I prefer doing one-to-ones with puppy owners so I can educate them. So that's in line with her ethology. And so I can educate on what's normal, what's not, that, you know, that in the home that we can do this and we can, do enrichment like this and we can get them more confident like this and we can take them on walks and do this, that, and the other, rather than drilling puppy sit-ups. That was her terms. Within a class, because it's about teaching the owners about what's applicable and how.
Yeah.
Which I agree with. I mean, what was your thoughts on it?
So, yeah, I found this one quite difficult to listen to, but I know why on reflection. And that's because in my puppy classes, the absolute maximum you will ever get is six. Normally it's four in a class.
Yeah.
And we do spend more time and we cover, you know, what you've just said, and the educating owners. For me, that puppy class is more about educating owners on what's normal, on doggy behaviour, on what to look out for, on what to do in the home, than it is static exercises. They're built in, don't get me wrong, but I understand where she's coming from, because if you look at other classes, it's very much about you've got to learn your basics. You sit, you stand, you're down, you stay, you recall. But we build all of that in. But I would say our classes are 75% education around what having a puppy is like and the things to do, and 25% these are your exercises. That actually, why don't you try your exercises at home, or when you're out and about on a walk, or you go to the park? That's what's really important, because there's all the different environments. But I can see where she's coming from for the classes that are perhaps more rigid in those puppy exercises. But I think that's where I was kind of like, but that's exactly what we do. But then I also recognise that's not what everybody does.
Yeah, I'm with you there, totally. After Steph, well, actually, we'll go to the question bit actually first about her. She is quite averse to crate training, which I know comes from Torrid.
Yeah.
But she did admit that she uses, like, baby gates or dog gates.
Yes.
And she's okay with the use of a pen. Now, I am very pro crate training.
Yeah, I mean,
there are limits to it. I understand, like anything else, anything can be used as a tool of cruelty.
Yeah.
A collar and lead, normal collar and lead, can be used as a tool of cruelty if used in the wrong way, as can a crate.
Yeah.
However, crate training, as in house training and things like that, for a new puppy, for in this day and age where people are so busy, to speed up that process, a crate is the best way to do it. If done in a kind and an effective way.
Yes.
Someone asked her about crate training and things, and she kind of said, well, you know, when I haven't crate trained any of my puppies, and she says it's just about committing that someone's got to be home with the dog most of the time while it's a puppy to supervise it, which I'm not disagreeing with, but it's not particularly practical.
It's not realistic.
It's not realistic. For people who are buying puppies nowadays, it's not like 20 years ago.
No, it's not.
You know, the mother, or, you know, there isn't someone at home all the time or 90% of the time to be able to keep an eye on that puppy. She did accept that, you know, you do need to puppy proof a home.
Yeah.
You know, wires and things like that. But if I was to get a puppy tomorrow, I would be crate training it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was one question I wanted to ask and I didn't get a chance, and that was to say, so you're saying, because her words were, when you have a puppy, someone needs to be with it, supervising it all the time, and it must always be supervised. I completely get that. But then she was also talking about her children. And I'm like, yes, but when you have children, let's be honest, at the same point that, say, your puppy would be, when it's getting to an age where it's probably going to need the crate and everything else, a lot of people would perhaps put their children into nursery while they go to work.
Yeah.
So I absolutely understand that. Well, that crate, if it's done properly, is the equivalent to me. It's a, okay, I've got to pop out to the shops. I want to make sure you're safe. Mm. I want to make you feel secure. Yeah.
It's not about it's not get in place. There, you're a naughty dog.
No, it's about you go in there, you have something nice, that's your cook. And actually what's really, really important for me with crate training, and this is something that we don't see enough of, is that puppies don't get enough downtime.
Mm.
So if they're constantly out and being supervised, when are they getting that 16 hours sleep that they need a day?
I think for families that are just like two adults, for example, and the puppy will opt to have some downtime as long as it's allowed to. However, if there are children around, then they don't get that option to have that.
They don't.
A minus crate, I'm talking about. Because the child wants to interact with the puppy, or just the child moving around and being a child and playing is too stimulating for the puppy, and it needs to switch off. So a crate helps with that.
Yeah.
Do you know what? You're going to have some downtime, mate. You need to sleep. Because puppies need about 20 hours a day.
They do. Well, that's it. I see this with adults all the time, though. And especially where it's a one-person home.
Mm.
And a dog, because it's such a big attachment, which is wonderful. But actually, that dog isn't getting that downtime. And that's when you start to see those behaviours come out that perhaps aren't, you know, quite so wanted. And it's actually when I say to people, give your dog the sleep they need.
Yep.
And they don't understand that they need so much. I'm like, minimum 16 hours. That's 8 hours through the night.
Mm-hmm.
And another 8 hours through the day, it's broken up.
Yep.
You know, and when you give that dog and that puppy time to sleep, that puppy comes a lot better. It's like, oh, I don't need to show all these different behaviours. Because it is like a toddler.
Yep.
You know, toddlers.
Overtired toddler. I don't want to go to sleep. Or you're just overtired and what they need is to sleep.
But the puppy, the only way puppies have got to tell us they're overtired is by nipping.
Yep.
Is by having wall of death around the lounge when they're having zoomies. That's it, stealing. All these behaviours are generally, I'm overstimulated, I'm overtired, I need to sleep. Yep. And we don't give them that opportunity.
Agreed.
And actually, if what we were talking about, you know, a lot of people will go on the wall, is asleep, how cute is that? Start taking pictures for Instagram or whatever else, but you're still disturbing that puppy.
Yep.
Whereas actually if they're in a crate, it stops you, it's a barrier from you going and disturbing that puppy.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
Oh, oh totally. The final speaker before the questions, which we've kind of covered anyway now, was Simone Muller. And we've both been on the Behaviour Bible course, which is through the School of Canine Science, and she was like the expert for the predation or chasing wildlife, for want of a better term, section of Behaviour Bible. So I was obviously very interested to see it. I think she's from Denmark.
Yes, I'm sure she is.
But, you know, speaks very good English. Yeah. And she did a demo with an Irish terrier who was lovely. And, you know, Lil's had an Irish, so, you know, she was besotted.
Yeah.
And it was a very, you know, I'm not a terrier person, if I'm really honest, but she, like, the Dee Dee, what's she called?
Yeah, Dee Dee.
Dee Dee was very sweet, very happy, but, you know, just very engaged. And there was a bit of a demo, and a lot of it was about treat relays, in a specific way, like counting out treats verbally, one, two, three, getting treats out of the treat bag, and working on that kind of weight and impulse control, and then, like, not just for chasing after prey, but there was an example where, or a video where Simone had opened the car door, the dog was in the back seat, and she counted out verbally, one, two, three, to ten, and then released the dog from the back seat and put all 10 treats on the floor, which, I'm not disagreeing. That can work really well.
Yeah.
Part of me is, like, I'm not sure it's worth verbally doing all of that.
It depends. So it comes from, so there's, and I can't remember who it is, I'm going to get it wrong now. It's whether Kamal or Shirag who's made that game.
It's Leslie McDevitt.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, my brain is, like, a bit fried today. And I use that game quite often, and actually verbalising it does help. And I have used it a couple of times in predation cases at the very end when we're practically finished with it. But I think we'll come on to the whole treats thing around that in a minute. But, yeah, it was, I don't know, for me as well. So she was basically saying that you're counting out these treats and getting the dog to keep their attention on you. But you've got to be very careful with your timing, because if you get to six, and this happened with the terrier a few times, and they're then looking away, and you're then waiting for them to reorientate back to you, well, by that time, you've lost, say, three.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you're not teaching the dog to keep their attention on you. You're also then rewarding for the dog looking away. So I'm a little bit unsure on that bit, if I'm honest with you, as to how that would actually work. I don't know.
Being totally honest, and this is what I said to Lil earlier when we were at the conference, I'm not an expert in predation in dogs that chase. I've worked with plenty of spaniels and, you know, gun dogs, essentially, yeah, of most varieties of gun dogs on these kind of issues. But I've mainly done it through a, this is their genetic need, their predisposition to chase, because that is part of their job, what they were bred, yeah, for. So we give that an outlet and actually teach them gun dog games and things like that. And that's how I've come at it. I've not got a lot of experience in true predation, as in dogs that will go off and try and kill a sheep, for example. Yeah. But something that I was taught many, many years ago. But, at the same time, I'm really honest about, that's not my specialty, I'm going to refer you to someone else. Or we'll give it a go, but I'll get you to a certain level, and then you're probably, yeah, going to have to go to someone else. But what I was told years and years ago was you should never reward chasing some livestock, wildlife, with food.
No.
Because the dog, and this goes back to what Ryan was saying earlier, mm-hmm, on in the day, not that it's competition against other dogs, but it's inequality. As in, if you're offering, even if you're offering the dog a chicken breast,
yeah,
it's not the same reward as a whole deer.
Yep.
You know, like, it just doesn't add up. So you shouldn't be rewarding with food. So when I've done stuff like that, if I'm not doing gun dog games, for example, I have played tog and things like that, but it's not my specialism. And I know you've done more around that.
Yeah.
So
I absolutely don't use food, purely because it's pretty pointless. So I've worked with numerous dogs, and I've got a great place by me that's basically a petting zoo, which is really handy because they've got double fencing and it's all very safe, and I've done predation cases there. I could be offering that dog sirloin steak and they'll go, yeah, but there's a whole sheep there.
Mm.
You know, and yes, you can. For me, the food reward is more of a distraction than actually desensitising them to the animal.
Mm.
So what's really nice about where I work, and I time it with kind of food time for the sheep. So we'll go in about half an hour before and we'll start to work through sort of engage, disengage and things like that. And then getting rid of that predatory behaviour using, you know, sort of like flirt toys and all of this stuff, sort of thing. And then the sheep will naturally run because they're going for their dinner. And that's when the dog will catch and go. And that's where you've really got to be on your game and go, actually, but this is so much more fun. And actually going to get so much more from this. And if you start adding food in there, they just go, oh, great, I'm getting food. You're not catering to that natural behaviour to hunt and to chase
and hunt.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of the work I will do is kind of like, you know, the rubber balls I've got the holes in, and then I'll, yep, put bits of fleece in. And I'm like, so especially for terriers, because they want to dissect, you get them to that point, you get them off, and then you go, actually, you're like, dissect this.
Yeah,
because they've got, they need to be able to finish that predation pattern.
Yeah.
So obviously it's different for different breeds, and we won't get into that, but, you know, if you've got a dog that needs to bite and then dissect, you've got to fill that for them.
Mm.
Because otherwise it's pointless. As she was also saying about what she does is she'll go into the woods and she'll let the dogs sniff, like, the deer trail. Now, I'm really careful about that because when I had a Weimaraner who had a really strong prey drive, if I then taught her, actually, you can go and sniff that track, it's a very fine line from sniffing the track and I'm being rewarded over here to I am following that track and I'm following that deer.
Yes.
You know, for me, it was all about, you can smell the deer, you can smell the rabbits, this is much better, I'm going to offer you something even better over here. And that's why I tend to, and I don't as much now, I do with Ignatius, I work with real animal hide. So I always used to have dummies with duck feathers on, yep, with deer hide, with rabbit hide, so that it was as real as possible.
Yeah, I've done that with dummies.
Yeah, and for predation, and this is a bit of a strange one, but I've actually found, and people are probably going to disagree with me on this, but this is what's worked for me. I worked with like a little pack of terriers once, Parsons terriers, And what really helped them, and this is going to sound completely ridiculous, is we had a piece of rope going between two trees. And they put them on a full prey diet.
Mm.
So we'd attach a dead rabbit to the piece of string. They'd chase it around. Then they'd catch it and they'd dissect it. And then we literally slowed down because they were so bad. They were on a farm. It was a nightmare. So we used to then slow down rabbit running. And then it was just they went on to a predation diet. And then they had other options to get rid of that chase and everything else.
But you were giving them an outlet.
I was giving them an outlet. That's it. Where they couldn't actually do any harm.
Yeah.
Because the rabbit's already dead. And then guess what? At the end, you can bite it, you can dissect it, you can eat it. And then you can take them out. It's under our control. Yeah. And then we take them out and they'd be like, oh, I'm not chasing after a wild one. That's way too fast. Why would I do that?
I'm satiated now.
Yeah, I'm done. I love it. Don't need it.
That is great.
And that's what I did with Packer Pass. And honestly, people looked at me like I'd lost the plot. And I was like, I am taking care of all of their genetic needs here.
Yeah.
And they're happy. And they're getting to finish that series. And I appreciated.
I think what I did like about Simone was in the panel Q&A at the end, someone asked a brilliant question, like basically to all of the speakers, of what studies or what papers would you like to see be done? What is what would you want to be able to take this industry forward? And there was various different answers, and all of them were great. And Simone said, basically, and I don't even think this was in, I think maybe she'd lost it because she was the last one.
Yeah.
I don't think this was in relation to a paper, but she was basically saying, why aren't more people looking at the initial signs of predation?
Yeah.
Which is like the orient, so like the dog is aware, they're looking.
The eye stalk.
Yeah, the eye stalk. And then before they get to this chase and dissect, chase, bite, dissect, kill, the early stages of this, they should be the ones that you need to address before they get to the chasing stage, which I totally agree with, which is the same with reactivity in my view. The dog is aware of another dog and the dog has the potential or has been reactive before. This is where we're going to work, not where they're being reactive. You've got to do it earlier. And also within that panel, what I really liked was Linda Michaels going back to the beginning.
Yeah.
She did put a few digs in a very good way. There's recently been a study, in inverted commas, done by a negative or punishment-based group, let's say, that is a very biased study about, apparently, how shock collars work and, well, I'm not saying they don't work, but
they're not evasive.
They're not aversive, basically. And it's a very biased study. I can't even say it's been peer-reviewed because, let's face it,
it's too new.
It's too new and it's just too biased. And there are many, many holes in it. And she gave lots of digs to that.
Yeah.
And she said that she wants to be able to have a study that can show that do no harm dog training or, you know, positive reinforcement can have more positive effects than that for the same kind of result, basically. I genuinely enjoyed today.
It was great. It really was.
It was. I mean, I'm tired now.
Yeah, I'm tired. But I've got to be honest with you, I mean, like I say, next year's is literally on my birthday and I would still happily go, but I've really enjoyed it today.
See, for the listeners, Lil, when she has a book.
And this is where the second half of the recording ended. What I was trying to say was Lil likes to celebrate the whole month of her birthday, not just the day. So I think she can afford to give up her actual birthday to go to Dog X again. But I hope you enjoyed that, something a bit different. And I'll be back next week with something else. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dog Gone Wrong podcast. If you could do me a quick favour, like or follow the pod, rate and leave a review, and maybe share with a dog-owning friend. Let's get the word out there and ensure there is less guilt around the mistakes. Thank you again. And we'll be back next week.